You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 14th of December, 2025. In grad school, I studied many things. I studied the history of Eastern Europe. I studied the international political economy with big names like David Rapkin and Wild Bill Avery. Who apparently is still alive. I don't know how. And, of course, political theory. So getting involved again in political economy is interesting to me. And especially since my book is out. You know it's out. It's on Amazon. There's an advertisement to your right. If you're watching this on Radio Albion or it's a ridiculous amount of work, on my end. It's not just the ridiculous amount of work that each one of these gets, but that book I slaved over. I don't even know. I've said it before, but I don't care. It's, there was something special about this book. So I'm asking you please to buy it. The problem with asking you to do that is the topic today, the collapse of the American economy. But on the other hand, I can't talk about the collapse of the American economy without talking about fake statistics. That I've been talking about for a very long time. Back in 2019, I published an article entitled Freedom and Cognitive Conflict, The Fantasy World of Postmodern Empire. In the early 90s, Albania, of all places, is probably the only thing they're known for other than heroin. Somehow, it got into their heads that capitalism was a pyramid scheme. And this is what you're supposed to do. Once the communist regime collapsed, there was no provision for supervision over regional banks whatsoever. So gang members ran them. About 7/8 of Albanians were involved in these. So there was no, the Socialist Party ends up winning the elections at very late 1991. But they really believed that capitalism was a pyramid scheme. You had to recruit people and they pay up. But it wasn't a public sector based problem. They were used to, you know, the state controlling everything. The IMF continued to feed the idea once the riots began, when it all collapsed, that the state was the cause and solution to the problem. And why was it directed at the government? Criminal gangs were mobilized and well-armed. They overwhelmed local police services. They were outgunned at each and every point. All military magazines were looted. The Gaji gang controlled large parts of the country. And to this day, this is what democracy means to many Albanians, especially Muslim ones. The economy collapsed completely again. And the West came in and insisted that elections and the free market was the solution. Now keep in mind, though, the Albanians entered into this out of ignorance. The Americans, however, entered into theirs out of brainwashing. And that's the issue we're dealing with today. I'm using both American and Russian sources on the coming collapse and the fraud of official economic statistics. if you gather all the official statistics you can get your hands on, I shouldn't even say official, but even in the private sector, you realize that they contradict each other. And not just inflation and GDP, we'll talk about that, but it's many other things. There's a lot of different ways you can tell how a country is doing economically. Things like inventory, retail sales, and all that. But you have to do a lot of research for that. My old friend Walt Garlington said, you know, the world isn't going to lose anything by the fall of the American Empire, because you can't have a nation built on pure materialism. The quest of money and pleasure will last very long. It can't. But with media control and fake statistics, not to mention plenty of wars, the typical American will go into this depression, which we're in right now and have been for a long time, having no idea he's in one. The U.S. has been in a depression since at least 2008 with zero recovery. That's why when they set interest rates at almost zero after 2008, nothing happened. Here's what I wrote in 2019. That is before COVID. In the U.S., less than 20% of all investment is directed to the actual production of goods and services, whereas more than 80% is invested directly in financial products. Of course, today it's far lower. The state cannot regulate these conglomerates. It's actually the other way around. A government that requires Wall Street to function at all, even making its military hardware, means that it, not the state, is the most powerful actor in society. At the time of the drafting of the Constitution, there was no such thing as a conglomerate. But most of the federal government is privatized today, so speaking of regulation doesn't make any sense. And this is where my conception of the regime came from. It's far more amorphous than just a state. We all know what happened in 2008. And then COVID, the COVID scam. The damage done by the COVID scam is in the tens of trillions. But even in between those two things, there was zero recovery, because there was no foundation from which a recovery could have taken place. After, you know, in 2009, you had 500,000 bankruptcies a month. Just because that lessened as time went on didn't mean things were doing well. No one noticed that foreclosure filing started to spike prior to the global financial crisis of that year, 2008. They never really stopped. During the month of October 2025, however, foreclosures were 20% higher than they were in October of last year. October alone, there were almost 37,000 foreclosures, i.e. the first step in the process. That's when a lender warns a borrower that they're in default. The worst places for this were Florida. One in every 1,829 housing units. South Carolina, one in every 1,982 units. Illinois, one in every 2,570 units, etc. Tampa, Jacksonville, Orlando, Riverside, Cleveland's at one in every 2,114. Well, no one really keeps track of evictions, so we have to extrapolate this data from places where, you know, where there is someone watching. One example is a place I got found called the Eviction Lab. It's at Princeton, actually, but it's a separate private institution. It tracks data, but only from 10 states. But even in those 10 states, it shows more than evictions more than a million evictions over the last year, and more than 78,000 just over the last month. Of course, part of the problem is that we don't have firm numbers because there's such a thing as the informal eviction or a huge increase in rent. That's a pretty easy way to push someone out. Used to be subprime mortgages. Now it's subprime auto loans. That proves without question the system is oligarchic because there's no market working here. There's no, you know, it doesn't make any sense that there would be subprime anything in the market. The share of those loans that are at least 60 days delinquent has reached the highest level ever recorded. Just now. There's some data you can get from Fitch Ratings data. So we're seeing auto loan delinquency spike, a huge surge in vehicle repossessions. Huge number of cars being repossessed. I don't know if I'm subscribed to this guy, this black guy on YouTube called Herb, E-R, or E-B. It shows him taking cars out of every place. It's shocking how fast it is. He can get in and out in just a few seconds. He took a car out of the car wash with suds on it and everything. People running after it. Now he's black, and almost everyone he repossesses from is black. And he operates in Cleveland, which is one of the worst areas for this. The Recovery Database Network has seen over 7.5 million repossession assignments. That is, you know, authorizations given over to guys like him to recover a vehicle. And then within a few weeks, it's going to be about 10.5 million. There were these usurious institutions like PrimaLend. That was a buy here, pay here auto financing market. And you deal directly with you know, dealers sell and directly finance vehicles for those with poor or limited credit. They were in bankruptcy last month or 2 months ago, but they still function. The other one is Tricolor. Both operating out of Texas, by the way. Texas in the Southwest. But that doesn't function at all anymore. So I can't tell if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Then, of course, we have job cuts. Sounds like I've been talking about this for a long time, but things are getting different. There's no more credit. Verizon's going to cut 15,000 jobs. That was up before Thanksgiving. From the Wall Street Journal. Now, the regime is suddenly allowing journalists to talk about the collapse of the American economy only because Trump is there. And they're trying to blame him. So now all of a sudden, you could even use the word depression. It's used very sparsely, but it's allowed to be used now. U.S.-based employers have cut more than 1.17 million jobs in 2025. That's worse than COVID. That comes out of a report from Challenger Gray and Christmas, outplacement firm. In 2020, of course, you had about 2 million. Since 1993, there's only been a few times you've had levels like that. 2002, you've had 1.3 million. 2009, you had 1.2 million. But now, you have the highest pretty much of all time. But since Trump has become president, the regime has given the green light to journalists to talk about economic collapse. It was forbidden under the Biden fraud. My God, they allowed secession and military coup to be talked about during the Biden fraud. Oh, sorry, during the first Trump term. There's one economist who has actually used the word, Jim Stanford. And he said, analysts, I guess him, analysts fear that the U.S. economy, which has been forecast for 2 years to be in recession, is actually slipping into one. That there's panic. In the minds of ordinary Americans, 80% of U.S. citizens believe the country is facing an imminent catastrophe. There have been food fights in supermarkets, especially with large black populations. And I noticed this when I've gone to the Russian media to study there. I mean, the American media is always talking about the Russian collapse. It never happens. The Russians certainly can talk about the American collapse, which very well will happen. Writer Maxim Stentkov, he says, people are panicking in anticipation of the possible civil war. They're starting to think about the most basic things, food and safety. They're probably digging basements for themselves in case of a nuclear or civil war and arming themselves. There's a few places where the ultra-wealthy live. There's one place in Florida. I think that there's really only 19 of the wealthiest families, and there's, you know, an army of private security, and there's a private island not too far away. I think many of you are aware that the elite have been figuring out options, whether they want to stay or not. The Russian media has brought up something that I never heard of before. The set someone else up and let them pay for you. The flash mob. The offender, almost always black, scans their item into a customer's receipt at the right moment and runs away in the supermarket. We've all seen educational videos about how to survive on a few dollars a week during shortages. You've seen that these terrible analyses, romantic, I shouldn't even say terrible, romantic analyses of these little tiny homes, you know, really shipping crates. But very few Americans put it together. So there is a question, though. Why now? I remember when I first started in this field, late 89, early 1990, both the left and the right were talking about the collapse of the middle class even then, and hence the collapse of the American economy in general. But if you want to talk about a pure, you know, economic collapse, not just middle class, but of everybody, well, that's been on people's minds for a long time. But the reality is nothing new was happening. Inflation was massive a decade ago, but the media told its readers to notice it only recently. The U.S. hit debt rock bottom due to inflation. I've been talking about this since COVID. You have zero production and billions of dollars being printed, or, you know, so to speak, bonds being sold or given away to elite banks. Former Federal Reserve Board Governor Christopher Waller said, "We recognize that the dollar may face some challenges to its dominance in the future, and we as policymakers are also mindful of potential financial stability challenges." Now, that's interesting. Very few words, a lot packed in there. Budget in the first 6 months of 2024, U.S. government spent $867 billion servicing the debt, which is now roughly at $35 trillion. Now, official statistics claim that net interest payments make up 14% of the budget. Only one thing is larger, Social Security. at 18%. But you know what? Whichever authority you go to, they're different numbers. And I'll tell you why. I wanted to find out the full amount of money the U.S. military was given by the federal government. The Defense Appropriations Act wasn't enough, because there were things in every other aspect of the budget that affected this. International relations and things like that. Well, there's also spending. Intelligence. So it's been over $1 trillion for a long time now. Now, and of course, the society really has no reason for existing except for American society, I mean, except for pleasure. You know, the worship of the Jews and minorities. It doesn't really have any purpose other than that. And so it's incapable really of responding as a society. That doesn't keep the U.S. government from expanding its presence and conducting new military operations, though. You know, Yemen and everything, Ukraine, Gaza. Now a build-up against China. But it's precisely through these conflicts. This is how the American order survives. What else could they do? They need to be able to control resources from elsewhere. Therefore, we need to get rid of the government that controls it. That's essentially nationalized or given over to the oligarchs, which is really one and the same thing. The risk, and this is from a Russian source, the risk of a U.S. default has reached the highest level in its history. The banking crisis, which continues, by the way, high inflation, the debt ceiling, does anyone take the debt ceiling seriously? Now, they won't call it a default. They'll call it something else. But injecting cash just doesn't make any sense. 2023 with, what, $300 billion more? It's hundreds of billions each year. And if it doesn't collapse soon, then mathematics is wrong. In terms of the banking crisis, I think last time I talked about this, about $4 trillion needed to be spent to fix it. In other words, to bail out the major bankers. The Swiss government provided $54 billion to Credit Suisse in Switzerland to prevent its bankruptcy in 2003. But nothing has changed since then. BlackRock even abandoned its takeover bid for that same bank. The rule of BlackRock came from this collapse. We're within it now. It's not in the future. We're in the midst of it. It's slower than the Soviet one. But, you know, Moody's downgraded the U.S. banking system. And it's only because Trump became president for a second term that you're not allowed to talk about it again. Brink of collapse? No, it's collapsing. Now, what are the options, really? You know, increasing taxes. I can't imagine it. Most of your blue chip stocks don't pay taxes. And pumping money into a society that doesn't produce anything is, of course, the main cause of inflation. And it's far higher than we realize. We'll talk about that here in a minute. And there's no one within the G20 that could help. The IMF, the World Bank, these are just consortium of major banks anyway. There's been a debt bubble that's been going on for decades. the foundation of American prosperity. I mean, I don't know, you know, either today or tomorrow. And I don't like using the word bubble. I mean, bubble is actually a good metaphor. But it gives the impression that if it pops, it's immediate. And the Soviet collapse was very fast. But I have to tell you, I think Soviet society, or at least Russians in Soviet society, were far healthier as a people than Americans today, in the 1980s, early 90s. That was the whole point of the Elon Musk thing early on in the second Trump presidency. The debt is unrepayable. And people like, you know, Janet Yellen, their whole purpose is to say stupid things like the U.S. is capable of maintaining fiscal stability. I mean, sorry, financial stability while increasing its debt to GDP ratio. It seems strange, though. It's odd to consider that the U.S. calls itself, you know, Trump called it the richest country in the world. And yet, given its level of debt, it owns nothing. I went to the debt clock just before I started to hit record, and it's at $38.4 trillion. State debt adds at least another $1 trillion to this. The household level credit card debt alone is around another $1 trillion. The trade deficit adds another $1 trillion at least. But credit card debt is not the only household debt. You know, student loans, you have mortgages, you know, car loans, etc. But credit card debt alone is $1 trillion. That's why it is nothing more than a multi-level marketing scam. The debt ceiling was actually introduced in 1917. It was under the pretext of issuing bonds to support the World War I effort. But if you could vote to raise it, then it doesn't mean anything. U.S. national debt has tripled since 2009. So interest payments alone cost the U.S. budget about $1 trillion annually. Now, I mentioned the Defense Department issue. It took a long time for me to find all the different places in the budget where defense-related things are dispersed. Well, it's the same thing for paying interest on the debt. So it's a lot more than $1 trillion. The budget, as ridiculously long as it is deceitful. The assumption is no one's actually going to go through it, which they're right. It's like the Talmud. I think it's at least as large as Social Security. The whole issue of stealing Russian assets, which still hasn't occurred. And creditors. The U.S. is a debtor nation. They have a lot of creditors. They'd be expecting payments. They're not going to pay for it if there is, in fact, a default. I think around the world, if not in the U.S. itself, American creditworthiness is pretty low. Same thing goes for the purchasing power of the population, as we all know. The so-called global market, or the global oligarchs, will go to more reliable currencies. However, BRICS has its own set of problems. To this day, I have no idea why South Africa is in it. South Africa's fourth world, they destroyed what the white government gave it. They have no right to be there. They have nothing. Except you know, the possibility of mining. But there are some Russian writers that say, yeah, the yuan and the ruble will benefit, but for the BRICS economy, will it be a good thing? The value of shares will fall because it's also calculated in dollars. Interest rates will rise. Loans become more expensive. Raw materials, oil, gas, metals become cheaper. Decline in exports, slow down in global economic growth. Well, as I've said about 100 times on here, Russia is in a position where it doesn't have to worry about that. Sanctions have been a boon to it. And what are sanctions other than a huge tariff? Dealing with this massive, the interest alone by, you know, issuing unbacked dollars and selling bonds. And the Russians are saying these are not reliable pieces of paper. You have major writers like Nikita Malsenkov, who's the vice rector of the Russian Presidential Academy of the National Economy and Public Administration. But I love their long titles. They did in the Soviet era, too. And they may try to call it a technical default, but it doesn't exist. A technical default is where they might be able to continue to pay, but they still don't. But then a pretext may be found, like a major war, which will write things off and will allow them to declare some sort of victory. And by them, I mean either the U.S. or the regime as a whole. The regime is far more powerful than just the U.S. The U.S. is their main tool. The regime would have a tough time without the U.S. It's the head of the Hydra. That is why it needs war. Overall thing, they think in their minds, starting a war is a pretext for defaulting on their debt. They won't pay the Chinese. It was precisely in order to have a plausible pretext for a technical default that the West needed the war in Ukraine. I mean, it's not the first time this happened. Two world wars, you had major economic crises solved. Yeah, we know the U.S. can't win, but the regime is more than the U.S. The U.S. is going into these wars. The regime doesn't care if it wins or not. Yes, the United States, especially with its ruling Jewish element, is the main source of all current conflicts in the world. But without war, there's nothing left for them to offer. They're kind of like Ukraine at this point. They don't have the market they used to. Talking about the U.S. here. The market's in serious crisis. The Chinese domestic market is and you keep in mind, China is the largest economy in the world, and they have been for a while, that actually produces things. So they're by far the largest economy in the world. Purchasing power parity. By that same measure, Russia is fourth. And whatever you think about Vladimir Putin, he took a country in the midst of third world hell and brought it to the fourth largest economy in the world in 20 years. What I'm trying to say is the collapse could be delayed maybe, but not totally averted. I mean, if you pay off debt with new debt, you know it can't remain. You can't keep doing that. I don't know if you guys have seen Michael Snyder's The Economic Collapse blog. I keep forgetting about it. And it's a great, they have just a handful of articles on there. But it's excellent. You can't get to it through Google. You have to go through I usually Yandex or something else. But how is this a shock? The Fed flooded the system with trillions upon trillions of new dollars, with no productive capacity being minimal. But what do you want? Food prices and gas prices have been skyrocketing since at least 2005. I don't recall anyone talking about inflation in 2006, 7, 8. Snyder talks about a Century Foundation study. Here's some results here. Now, this is today. It deals only with registered voters in the U.S. 29% of registered voters said that they delayed or skipped medical care over the past year because they simply couldn't afford it. 24% said they delayed or skipped buying medicine prescribed by their doctor. 64% of poll respondents said they switched to cheaper groceries or had to cut back on them substantially. 34% said that they skipped the meal to save money. And 48% said that they tapped into savings to meet daily expenses. Well, I don't think they have savings. I think that means grandma, grandpa, or even crime. Ultimately, though, what is the AI revolution if it's not just cheap labor and avoiding responsibility? We're surplus population, as far as the regime is concerned. The housing market, the same way. See, they won't use the word collapse, they'll use word correction. Well, unless you're talking about Trump. BlackRock has bought millions of American properties. So it became very difficult to sell homes, even today, at absurdly elevated prices that exist. So most people are pulling their listings. 85,000 sellers removed their properties in September 2025, the highest number for the month in 8 years. The number of stale listings, those for 60 days or more, jumped to the highest level for any since September of 2019. So it's not a matter of the collapse occurring. We're in the middle of it. But when you have firm media control, fake statistics, wars going on, a make-believe political debate, it's easy to miss. Now, the second part of this. The regime is based on deceit. And that goes to their own economic statistics, which are really how people, debate about these things, how they feel about the world. I've been saying for many years what counts as GDP growth is laughable. I think it was Lawrence Romanoff that said if you have two countries with identical economies, but yours has a higher divorce rate, the legal fees and other costs of the divorce process will be added to your nation's economic output. That means your country will have a higher GDP. Well, does that mean you're richer? Well, no. Certainly, it means it's a far worse place to live. What about all these billions and trillions in lawsuits now for any stupid thing? That is added to the GDP. You think the letter P for product, production, has something to do with making things? But it's not. It's any invented source of income, no matter how ridiculous it is. You have $1 trillion, at least, well, about 1.1, 1.2 trillion spent on the U.S. military every year. They are now included in the national statistics in coming up with the full GDP figure. That wouldn't have been done 40 years ago. That has nothing to do with production. The point is that when you have a society that only 20% of capital is actually producing anything, and that's gone way down since I wrote that a few years ago, you can inflate the GDP number, but have nothing to do with wealth or production. Or even worse, it can serve to enrich only a few people. Everyone else is left poorer. Larry Romanoff wrote this. Let me quote him directly now. "It should also be obvious that a nation like the U.S. that has privatized most physical and social infrastructure will produce a higher GDP than a country like China, where the basic infrastructure is owned by the state. The U.S. prison system is a good example of a service that cost the taxpayers $20 billion before privatization and $80 billion after. That served to increase the GDP by $60 billion. Only a few people were enriched by the process, while millions were impoverished, and society not measurably better off." And it gets worse when you start talking about financial things like derivatives. Things like, you know, airports, highways being sold to private investors, that goes to the increase of GDP. Well, it's certainly not productive. So much of it actually shows impoverishment. In fact, so much of these things, like fees and, you know, toll fees and everything else, when you privatize the service that used to be state-owned, that bleeds you dry over time. The much increased charges by private equity will increase the GDP on paper, but that has something nothing to do with purchasing power. I mean, that's you know, this is pretty simple. And speaking of purchasing power, that's why you need the PPP measure. And it looks very, very different. You have something like 60 or 70%, depending on who you read, of the entire GDP being financial instruments. 60% of the state of GDP is essentially book entries, transferring money from one account to another. That is not production. That is not a service. So if you were to remove the financialization element, you have to subtract 50 or 60% from the GDP. Then what do you get? You don't get a great power. So GDP is not relevant here. If you use purchasing power parity, I could see. Because all these things are taken into account. I mean, there was a time where it was a simple measure of goods and services. China is by far the world's largest economy, not just in sheer bulk, but it actually produces things, whatever problems it might have. It's also the largest debt collector. The U.S. is the largest debt payer. China's infrastructure is unmatched as America's crumbles. China's AI surpasses America, for whether that's good or bad is a different story. Thanks to Russia, her military hardware also surpasses America. China does not participate in global wars. They don't have bases, hundreds of, or thousands of bases over all over the planet. China is stockpiling. I'll give you another example here, and this is something I've never mentioned before, but it's done at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This is where saddle statistics came from, if you remember me talking about them years ago. But the concept of imputed rent. So if you own the house you live in, the government will add to the GDP the amount you would have had to pay in rent, but don't, because you're an owner. That adds about almost $2 trillion, 15% to the U.S. GDP. And since it lies about inflation all the time, that would take even more away. What would you have left? Imputed rent is you know, it's something straight out of the Talmudic mind. Anything to plausibly create this notion of the U.S. as a great power. So ultimately, if the theory is, if your average house would rent for, let's say, $40,000 a year, this amount is added to the average income of all homeowners. As far as the creation of GDP is concerned. So as far as the U.S., the GDP number is ridiculous. Now, your median per capita income, median is not average. Median is when you list them all and you pick the one in the middle. That's around $35,000. Per capita, it's about the average would be about 55,000, and they come from the imagination entirely. And you know, you could estimate the amount that imputed rent provides. It goes for business ownership too. You take all these things into consideration. What is the U.S. GDP in reality? American wealth and high annual incomes are pure mythology. Rampant poverty, middle-class households, living purely on credit to maintain what little standard of living they have, deferred retirements, bankruptcies. I'll never forget my Uncle Edward, after the 2008 collapse, had to go back to work because his pension was taken. You know, had been invested in one of these companies. Remember, money doesn't disappear. It always just changes hands. He had to go back to work. I don't know. I don't remember even what he did at 80 or 75, whatever he was. Inflation. It were calculated today. I know I've said this many times before. By the same statistical methods used, say, in the late 70s. The official inflation rate would have to be much, much higher, far more than 10%. Let me quote him again here, Romanov here again. These false inflation statistics also involve a massive financial fraud, the theft of countless billions of dollars from the American people by their own government. The reason is that all Social Security payments, welfare and food support, and other items are linked to the rate of inflation and are legislated to increase each year to cover the actual increases of the cost of living. But since the U.S. government deliberately understates the inflation rate by at least 10%, it's far more than that, all SS benefits have been underestimated and underpaid by that amount. So compounded annually, Social Security and many, many pensions and many other payments would be at least 100% higher than they are today. He says 70%. He's being cautious about it. How is inflation calculated? Well, most people will tell you it's the consumer price index. Now, they've had to create new categories, and how this has been manipulated is really beyond, you know, a normal person shouldn't be shocked they don't understand it, because only the Talmudic mind could come up with it. If you want to lower the quoted CPI, you just take items away. They invented something called core inflation. Core inflation is most of the things that would cause inflation, because it eliminates things most critical to consumers, like food and fuel. Which creates a make-believe picture. So measuring inflation without food and energy is laughable. The other phrase, and I mentioned this before, is the substitution effect. It means that, for example, when beef prices rise, the public won't purchase it anymore and they'll buy chicken instead. Now, that part, you know, that's as far as that goes, it's okay. But in the minds of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, because we're not buying beef, they can remove it from the inflation calculation. So when the price of something increases, the Labor Department just eliminates it from calculation and substitutes something cheaper. And that's it. No inflation. Let me quote Romanov again. Another clever trick is to arbitrarily reduce the severity of price increases when some prices are increasing rapidly, as oil prices often do. The government ruled that if an item's pricing rises too quickly, people will use less of it. So with any rapid price increase, the U.S. government reduces its weighting on a CPI calculation. So for example, healthcare is about 17% of GDP. But it was given a weighting of only 6% because the real health costs are rising. This alone reduces the U.S. CPI by several percentage points. For both the above, it should be clear the U.S. government is not recording actual price increases. In other words, actual inflation, but is instead recording fictitious consumer behavior in the face of strong price increases. It's to the point where they're simply making things up. He uses another example, which I'd never thought of before. Let's say you have a home appliance that's priced at $400, and they get improved every model year as time goes on. The assumption is that each one is worth $150, which means the basic appliance is only now $250. That's what's used then in calculating the CPI, meaning that the price of the item has gone down. And in fact, that manipulation is applied to almost 50% of all items contained in the calculation of the CPI, which is where the inflation rate comes from. You know, it's a very, very, it's a twisted mind. Shadow Statistics, which I have been, they should give me a free membership, by the way, because I've been pushing them for so long. They walked out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics years ago. We're not going to lie for you anymore. I had to take statistics to the doctoral level. And I was at Missouri St. Louis. It was painful. I know how to do regression analyses and all that stuff. But that's not even that. This is simply make believe. Job creation. Ugh. Millions of jobs created under Trump in just a few months. There is no distinction between part-time and full-time work in the Labor Bureau. Low-paying jobs now account for almost half of all employment growth. In 1 month, U.S. government listed a large number of new jobs in retail trade. But that couldn't have been, since the major retailers like JCPenney and Macy's and Sears, who went out of business entirely, Dollar Store, were all in trouble in closing stores. And shopping centers didn't have tenants anymore. So where's that coming from? The statistics used in debate are fraudulent. Romanoff is a good writer, but he wants to be more cautious than me. I realize that the inflation rate is much, much higher. It'd be something like, unemployment is probably like 30%, 35%. It's probably the same for inflation, but they can't say that. %80 of all the dollars in existence right now have been printed just over the last 3 years. So how can inflation remain under control? The only way is through lying about it. The Consumer Price Index, this basket of goods, is manipulated. I think it's like 1,000 goods now. I've talked about it in other places too. And, that CPI is used for the Federal Reserve's monetary decisions too. There's something, when I talked about the appliance, let's put it this way. The phrase is hedonic quality adjustment. So the discount the price of the product by a certain indicator, if its quality growth improves. I know it's weird. This is how Gregory Van Kipnis, chairman of the American Institute for Economic Research, explains the essence of this. Okay. If a butcher increases the price of a steak by 10%, claiming it is now has less fat, 10% more protein, then from the U.S. government's perspective, there was no increase in the price of steak. How would the government report the steak component to the CPI? From the government's perspective, there was a qualitative improvement in consumer health and the health of the planet. So it would report that the price of steak didn't increase at all. There was no price increase and thus no inflation. That's just another example about the household appliance I mentioned above. I know I should have explained that in more detail. But it does have a name. It's hedonic quality adjustment. It's just another lie. The problem is that's applied to housing, cars, computer equipment, and everything else. That goes back to the 1980s, in fact. Inflation in the U.S. officially was 13.5% in 1980. But the new methods that adopted roughly around that time, it dropped to 3% in 3 years. How was that possible? Even the New York Times admitted it. If they admit it, you can't argue with them. They're Jewish. And here's what the New York Times said. In 1983, the government switched from using home prices, which also included mortgage payments and maintenance costs, to using rent prices to estimate home values. Home values for people who own their homes are now measured using what's called the owner-occupied equivalent rent. How much would it cost to rent their home if they didn't own it? As I mentioned above, too. It's all the same concept. This is how, these are some of the ways that in the early 80s, inflation went very high to very low in just over a couple of years. Consider it the replacement of expensive, you know, the home thing is different, but the replacement of expensive products with cheaper ones. It's like a hedonic adjustment. Price increases due to improved quality are not counted as inflation. Those items that had actually increased were simply excluded from the consumer basket used to calculate the CPI. One of the Russian sources I know cited shadow statistics. It's John Williams who created that portal. Now, he has his own CPI method. He has a consumer basket of goods with fixed quantities and qualities and over different cities. Using that, which is the older method, U.S. inflation rate rose to more than 16% just in the spring of 2022. It's actually higher than that. The economist, David Ranson, has mentioned this as well. I mean, people are catching on. Ranson holds that rising commodity prices are a better indicator of current inflation. This is what we're talking about here. You have a basket of, there's actually, Ranson has a basket of precious metals as his CPI. But those two, Williams and Ranson, had a joint study comparing the November 2006 Consumer Price Index data that was released by the BLS. They stated that during the first 11 months of 2006, the officially reported CPI rose at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 2.2%. Williams' estimate of CPI growth over the same period was 5.3%, while Ranson's estimate was even higher at almost 9%. But the CPI isn't just about inflation. It also plays a key role in determining the size of the GDP. Paul Singer, a Jewish billionaire, hedge fund manager, he wrote, I think it was about 2014, he said the U.S. government is manipulating statistics, falsifying data on GDP, jobs, inflation, and household income. This massive scam will soon be exposed. Now, this is what he wrote to his investors concerning the third quarter of 2014. No one can predict how long the authorities will get away with this phony economic growth, fake money, phony financial stability, fake jobs, and understated inflation income figures. In our view, confidence, especially when unjustified, can quickly evaporate. When confidence is lost, it can lead to serious, abrupt, and simultaneous consequences across a wide range of markets and economic sectors. But Bloomberg, the publication, was very upset by this, and they went to Elliott Management, another Jewish hedge fund, hoping to get this refuted. And what the founders, what they said was, "We believe the global economy and financial system are in a kind of artificial stupor in which no one, including ourselves, has a clear idea of what tomorrow will look like." That's about as far as he will go. So in other words, economic elites know this. They know that the numbers are fraudulent. This is why I say the U.S. has been in a depression since 2008, at least. There were recessions in 1986, 1995, but the new methods flattened them out. They were missed entirely. What about COVID? Well, 2008 is just a world in and of itself, but what about COVID? What is the total economic cost of COVID that we know of so far, and the nonsense lockdowns? The economic losses, when you factor all elements, is around $20 trillion. When I mean elements, I mean lost wages, lost businesses, deficit spending, stock market crash, all that. It does not include indirect losses. You going to tell me how to? There's a recovery from this? The arbiter of American recessions is a group called the National Income and Product Accounts, NIPA. That was the concept and development of the National Bureau for Economic Research. It was founded in 1920. They decide what reality is. But as part of this, the construct of GDP, that is to say, you know, aggregate economic growth, is reliant on economic theory for its composition. Now, I've been saying this for a long time. We know the Russian economy can't be doing well because it's impossible, because they're not like us. Unlike other data series like retail or you know, trade deficit. It used to be the GNP was used, but once the trade deficit got so high, the outflows, the GDP will not count those outflows. Remember, the difference between the GNP and the GDP is the GDP is only within America's borders, having nothing to do with anything going on with American investment abroad. And the GNP, it's the broadest economic measure that includes GDP plus the balance of international flows of interest and dividend payments. But because the U.S. is a debtor nation, a massive debtor nation, they switched to GDP, so that won't be counted anymore. But where else can you go for information? Well, in the Russian press, I don't remember who did this here. Well, it doesn't matter. The Internal Revenue Service, if you go to them and their aggregation of the income tax returns, they will tell you that wages are collapsing. Let's say, so back in 2002, they said for the second consecutive year, adjusted gross income fell, decreasing by 2.3%, or $6 trillion for 2002. Two consecutive years of total collapse. So if you go to the official statistics, wages and salaries went up 6.8%. This is 2002, but it could be any year it's the same. It doesn't matter. Well, no, the IRS says they went down 0.04%. interest income. The official number is negative 6.4%. But no, the IRS, who would know better, says it's negative 20.9%. Then dividend income, which the official number went up, says went up by 5.1%, actually went down by 15%. Again, it's all of these imputations I mentioned above. Not to mention the simple political demands that these numbers look good. But the IRS will show you the true number. They certainly have every reason to be truthful in this regard. I'll repeat my thesis again. We don't have to talk about the when an economic collapse is going to happen. We're in the midst of it. It's not going away. But when you see this kind of manipulation, you can't talk about economic collapse without talking about how the U.S. government and some of its private sector allies manipulate data. And I know I threw a lot at you there, but that's kind of what I do. That's how I know there's been a depression since 2008. There's been no recovery, simply on the logical basis that there's no basis for a recovery, especially if you're a white man. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.